This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Pope goes to Africa, implications of Paris climate talks for the continent, historic elections in Burkina Faso, and combating extremism. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. On his first visit to the continent, Pope Francis visited Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. In Kenya and Uganda, he chiefly spoke out about Islamist extremism, corruption, and inequality. In the Central African Republic, the pontiff, making his first trip to a war zone, called for warring factions to lay down their arms and begin to work towards peace. Pope Francis's visit came at a time when the nation is getting ready for presidential and parliamentary elections. And speaking of elections, Burkina Faso held its first truly open election in 27 years. Roch Kumar Kabore won a majority of votes, rendering a runoff unnecessary. Previous President Blaise Compaoré had seized power by force and won four elections, all of which were disputed. Analysts say the historic election could serve as an example of democratic transition to other African countries, where veteran rulers are changing the constitution to pave the way for extended terms in office. Well, with us to explore the results of the pontiff's visit, implications of the COP21 talks in Paris, Burkina Faso's vote, and the ever-present challenge from Islamist extremists, we turn to two distinguished analysts who are no strangers at these VOA microphones. Ambassador David Shin is former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, currently professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and he blogs at the official blog of Ambassador David H. Shin. And J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a very distinguished policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Well, Ambassador Shin, let me begin with you talking about the Pope's visit, the themes, the reception he got, and any kind of impact you see lasting from his visit.
I think the two primary themes that I detected in his visit to the three countries that you cited are an emphasis on Muslim-Christian harmony, which came out particularly in his visit to the Central African Republic, and also combating the war on poverty. That came out almost everywhere, and is a theme that he has emphasized in many of his visits around the world. There were some sub-themes dealing with climate change, corruption, a variety of other things, but I think they were much less important in his overall thinking about this visit. He made a couple of very interesting comments, controversial perhaps, but I found them very intriguing. For example, he pointed out that the wars of religion have always existed in talking about Muslim-Christian harmony, and laid blame on all religions, not just Islam. And he also pointed out that fundamentalism is a sickness in every religion, which I think was particularly controversial. I think he's right about that, but he's going to get, I'm sure, a certain amount of flack. Of course, it all depends how you define fundamentalism, too.
All right. Well, now for your take, Peter Pham, on the pontiff's visit to the continent.
I would focus in particular, although the visit was historic to all three countries, in Kenya, certainly, where there's a very vibrant and still growing church, to Uganda, where he celebrated the martyrs of Uganda, both Anglican and Roman Catholic, from over a century ago. But I think most significantly, the visit to that war zone, the Central African Republic, where not only do you appeal for greater harmony, but this is a country where the main peacemakers have been the religious leaders. An extraordinary trio of the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Bangui, the Imam Omar Kabine, who's the head of the Islamic community there, and the president of the Evangelical Association have worked together assiduously and not only worked together, but also saved each other quite literally during the past 2 years. They're an extraordinary trio. They've been celebrated justly around the world, but giving them some additional support. And then finally, that country is approaching its presidential election at the very end of this month. That election was supposed to have been held back in September, but had to be postponed because of renewed violence. It was then given a new date early this month, but that date was likewise postponed till now the 27th is the first round. And that's going to be a very critical moment for the country's future.
Turning back to you, Ambassador Shin, to continue on the Pope's visit to the continent, And of course, we should make note that in Africa, that's where there's the world's fastest growing Catholic population, evidently. So certainly one of the reasons why he made the trip. But still, many say it was very brave of him, particularly going to a war zone in CAR. Do you think anything he said or did will change anything concretely henceforth?
Over the short term, perhaps not, but I think over the longer term, he will get more people thinking about the futility of effectively a Muslim-Christian war going on in the Central African Republic, and put it in the context of history that this is not all that unusual, but it has never come out well when it continues. And if he can just get people thinking, if he can help bring Muslim and Christian leaders together, as Peter suggested, then that is a good thing, and I think that will have some positive benefits. And I certainly applaud his trip to the CAR. I think it was a very courageous thing for him to do, and the way he did it was so open when he went around the capital.
Indeed. Back to you, Peter Pham. On any kind of impact you think his visit, his words will have on, for example, reconciliation in CAR, on trying to tamp down any kind of misunderstandings, Muslim-Christian misunderstandings?
I agree with Ambassador Shin that perhaps in the short term, we're not going to see, other than the enthusiasm during the days when the pontiff was there, an immediate result. But I think there can be some long-lasting results. And even in the intermediate term, I think he went out of his way in the visits he made in Bangui, not only to the Roman Catholic Cathedral, but also to the youth rally, and then visiting a mosque, as well as refugees from both sides. He went out of his way in those gatherings to also single out some really courageous individual. I mentioned earlier Imam Omar Kabine Layama, but also the Roman Catholic Archbishop there, Dieudonne Nzapala Zinga. These are people who have risked their lives, and that stature that his visit and the fact that he recognized them as individuals will give them, because they've been peacemakers, but also peacemakers with their eyes wide open. They've, on a number of occasions, challenged both the transitional government and the UN force for its failures, their failures, and also criticized some steps. So I think giving them that additional prestige that Philip is very useful and constructive for the country.
Back to you, Ambassador Shin. And again, talking about the Pope, who is very passionate about climate change, has written an encyclical. And with respect to Africa, as we speak, climate talks are taking place in Paris. And I heard one African diplomat say at the COP21 talks that others pollute and Africa pays. Sort of sums up what many in the developing world think. You know, they want to progress, they want to develop, but then they feel constrained because they aren't able to use the kinds of fossil fuels that have contributed to, of course, this unfortunate global warming. So what to do about that? But let me ask you, do you see some sort of a united front at all with respect to Africa and its posture vis-a-vis the climate change talks? Now, I know it's not a monolith. You have South Africa, very developed. You have then Chad, on the other hand. But any kind of a theme or position that African leaders are taking?
Well, the African Union has tried for a number of years to come together on agreeing on general outlines of dealing with the challenge to climate change in Africa. It was particularly effective, I think, when former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia was leading the group. He, of course, is deceased now, and I'm not sure that it is quite as effective as perhaps it once was, but I think there is a keen desire by the Africans to come to some conclusions so that they can put pressure, particularly on developed nations, to be more helpful to the continent. Their major effort has been the solicitation of assistance to deal with climate change. And the Africans are right in that they produce only about 2% of global CO2 emissions, and yet they have far higher percentage of the world's population. So it's the industrialized countries, and now increasingly China and India, who are the major emitters of CO2. China has actually passed the United States, although the U.S. is still the largest per capita emitter. And Africa is probably going to be more impacted in a negative sense by climate change than any other part of the world. And they, as a result, are focusing on it and are putting pressure on others to help them out.
J. Peter Pham, how do you see the African position vis-a-vis these climate talks since, as Ambassador Shin said, you know, Africa constitutes only 2% of the global CO2 emissions, and you have China and India both very interested in investing in Africa, who are now, you know, the largest emitters in addition to the United States. Where does Africa stand in all of this?
Ambassador Shin raised several very good points, and let me echo them and amplify some of them. Africa, in a way, is hit by a triple whammy with climate change. First, many African countries are sources of energy in terms of fossil fuels, hydrocarbons, oil, natural gas, the very things that we're going to try to cut the emissions of. So they're going to lose out on the ability to sell these primary commodities, which have been driving the growth of some of them. Then there's the fact that disproportionately, Africa does not emit CO2, as Ambassador pointed out, and yet it's being affected, thirdly, by the effects of climate change. Ironically, some of the biggest polluters, the developed world, the global north, there have been maps put out by numerous climate scientists, environmental scientists, and intelligence agencies about areas of the world that will actually see more production and greater yields, and they're in the north. Polluters will actually benefit from the pollution, and the ones who haven't been emitting CO2 will suffer droughts, lower production. So it's politically fraught to imagine that we're going to easily get global transfers of wealth. But something has to be done. And if we're looking toward a future of renewables, certainly there's great potential in Africa, but that potential needs capitalization to get it going.
Turning back to you, Ambassador Shin, to move on to the fight against terrorism. Again, we witnessed attacks in Mali, the constant threat from Boko Haram in Nigeria that now is nominally affiliated with so-called ISIS-Daesh, and the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb still threatening swaths of land from Libya to Mali, Algeria. Let's start with the Mali attacks. What do we know as a result of these attacks about the continuing threat?
Well, the situation in Mali is very disturbing, and it is indicative of a much broader problem where the whole issue of terrorism is metastasizing. We all know that. There are so many groups out there now that, frankly, I have trouble keeping track of all of them. In the case of the attack on the Radisson Blu Hotel in Bamako, there are now three groups that have allegedly taken credit for it. One is Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and then you have two much smaller, lesser-known groups, one of which claims to have an association with AQIM, and the other claims to have had some association with Ansar Dine, which is a somewhat better-known group in the area. The issue, I think, has gone really far beyond the immediate terrorist threat. It's the whole question of Salafism and the degree to which the Salafists want to achieve their goals. And you have in Mali today, by some estimates, somewhere between 10% and 15%, no one really knows the precise percentage, of Malian Muslims who follow Salafist principles. Well, that in and of itself is not necessarily worrisome because it's the question of the tactics they use to achieve their goals. And if they're simply the missionary kind of Salafists who very quietly behind the scenes try to encourage people to follow them, that's one thing. Now, even if they're political Salafists and they try to do it through the political process, that perhaps is okay. But when you become jihadi Salafist, then you have a real serious problem on your hands. And I think we're seeing more and more of that with organizations like Boko Haram and these various groups that are now operating in Mali.
Turning to you, J. Peter Fum, how do you read the attack in Bamako on the Radisson Blu? Do you agree with Ambassador Shin that it's more than just sort of a terrorist threat, but it's a question of Salafism and the tactics used to promote this very narrow and perhaps distorted view of Islam?
Well, let me make three points about the attack on Mali. First, the attack on the Radisson Blu caught global attention, coming as it did a week after the Paris attacks. But in reality, it is the third attack on a major place like that just this year alone. In August, there was an attack on a hotel in Sèvre, another town in Mali, that left several people, including UN workers and security personnel, dead. In March, just literally blocks from the Radisson Blu Hotel, very popular restaurant was attacked again with a number of foreigners killed. In between, there have been up to 3-4 dozen attacks on the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, in various parts of Mali throughout the course of this year. In fact, the UN mission in Mali has the not so flattering or desirable sobriquet of being the deadliest UN mission to be on, a blue-helmeted mission, because of these attacks. So 2 years after the French intervention, there's still a great deal of insecurity in Mali, point one. Point two, it also calls our attention to the fact that the very same week that the attacks occurred, a research center published the Global Terrorism Index using 2014 data, and tellingly, the deadliest terrorist group in the world was Nigeria's Boko Haram. They had 6,500 and some odd victims, 500 more than the so-called Islamic State did. And from data that I've been seeing, they're on track again to beat the Islamic State this year. So there's a great deal of jihadist violence in Africa that perhaps doesn't get the attention. Just the other day, Vice Admiral Franken, the number two at U.S. Africa Command, made the point that Libya is becoming the second largest concentration of Islamic State fighters. He pointed out that in the town of Sirte, which is the late Muammar Gaddafi's hometown, went from 200 Islamic State-affiliated fighters in February to over 2,000 today, which is an extraordinary tenfold increase. These are things that we have to bear in mind looking at this greater context, and it's worrisome.
It is. We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador David Shin, former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He's currently a professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and J. Peter Pham, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based here in Washington. And we're discussing African issues, the Pope's recent visit, climate change and politics, including, in a moment, the results from the historic elections in Burkina Faso. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Evangelist Joe Kofi. He's a Ghanaian who works at the Leadership Academy in Nasarawa State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Ambassador Shin. In the few minutes we have left, I want to go very briefly to Nigeria, Boko Haram, and then talk about Burkina Faso. With the election of President Muhammadu Buhari, do you think that he now has instituted a better strategy and has applied the resources necessary to defeat Boko Haram?
Well, there clearly has been improvement since he took over the presidency, and Boko Haram has been pushed out of a number of areas that it previously occupied. Having said that, just a couple of days ago, it overran another military base in the north, so it still has the capacity to not only seize, at least briefly, critical territory, but a great deal of Nigerian government arms in the process, including a tank and some other wheeled vehicles. So the problem remains significant, but I do give President Buhari credit for making a lot of progress, and I think the help that he is getting from particularly the Chadians and the Cameroonians is critical to all of this, because Boko Haram has expanded its efforts in those two countries in addition to Niger, and of course the United States has sent some 200 advisors to northern Cameroon to help out the Cameroonians in all of this. Progress is being made, but Boko Haram is a long way from being defeated.
Peter Pham, a long way from being defeated, Boko Haram, but do you think that President Muhammadu Buhari is on the right track, is making a significant difference?
He's starting to make a difference. Clearly, he came into the presidency with a lot of goodwill, not only within Nigeria, but in the international community. The key is going to be, how much can he change and how quickly? Because it's very difficult to undo a decade and a half of really the hollowing out of the Nigerian military. And to rebuild that as an institution, to train it properly, that's going to take time. And time is something that, as the attacks that Ambassador Shin just mentioned underscore, time is not something that they have a great deal of.
We're turning to a brighter spot. Back to you, Ambassador David Shin, about former country in which you served, Burkina Faso. Held historic elections. What do you make of the results, and how do you read the outcome?
Well, I'm pleased that you are dealing with a good news story here. And indeed, I arrived in Ouagadougou as ambassador in 1987, a couple of months after Blaise Compaoré took power. And he's been in power all the way up until last year. So this is a very good news story for Burkina Faso, for Burkina Bay, and for Africa generally. It had some hiccups in the immediate period after Compaoré was removed from power during the transitional period, but by all accounts, the election seems to have been done very, very well. The new president, President Compaoré, was elected with about 54% of the vote. They had 60% turnout of the electorate. Burkina Bay civil society monitored the election in great detail. The European Union, the Economic Community of West African States had monitors there. They all concluded that it was a free and fair election. And the principal losing candidate congratulated the winner at the end of the election. So this sets Burkina Faso on a very good trajectory, which it's now up to the new president to fulfill. And that's what the Burkina Bay are going to watch.
Peter Pham, how do you see the elections, and do they have meaning beyond Burkina Faso, for others, as we said earlier, some countries, whether Burundi or Rwanda, looking to extend terms in office, presidents for life.
I join Ambassador Shin in wishing President Kabore well with the extraordinary task that he has in front of him. He's going to be inaugurated on the 14th of this month, and he's got his work cut out for him. However, I think among the lessons we need to take also from this, and here I'm going to sound a slightly down note, although I have no doubt that the choice of the president reflected the will of the majority of people in Burkina Faso, there are also the procedural issues that we should not rush into elections merely to have them. My concern with the Burkina Bay election is not that it was carried out in anything but a free and fair manner, but then the lead up to it. In May, legislation was passed by the transitional government, which banned those who supported former President Blaise Compaoré's attempt to get another term of office from participating in the political process. That meant that many of his supporters, including his former party, the CDP, were excluded from this election. Now, would they have won? I highly doubt it. But they at one time represented, if not a majority, certainly a large segment of the population who were not given a voice or an opportunity to lose gracefully in this election. Immediate impact, none that I foresee. Long term, though, this is not the way to build an inclusive society. So I think one of the lessons to take away is, yes, the international community and the Burkina Bay did a lot of things well, but there are some things that can be improved upon, and I think those are some lessons to be taken away as well.
Well, as we conclude, Ambassador Shin, just quickly, we know that the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation is taking place. Talk about the significance of that, and, you know, where does this leave the United States vis-a-vis our influence in the continent?
The Forum on China-Africa Cooperation takes place every 3 years. This is the sixth one to occur since it began in the year 2000, but it's only the second one at the summit level or chief of state level, so that makes it somewhat more important. I think this one is going to be significant for several reasons. One, the economic downturn in China itself is playing out in Africa, creating some challenges. The purchase of commodities from Africa, for example, the lower price of oil, which has nothing to do with the downturn of the economy in China, but it's making the economic situation in Africa somewhat more difficult because the Africans were relying very heavily upon imports by China. And these are now, I think, on the decline, at least in terms of dollar value because of commodity prices. It also is important because I think the Chinese are looking at Africa with a little bit more concern in terms of security of their own personnel in the continent. Three Chinese were killed at the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako. Chinese were kidnapped about a year ago in northern Cameroon by Boko Haram. They're running into the same kinds of threats that Westerners have encountered for many, many years in Africa, and I think this is going to be on the table for discussion. This is an important meeting, and it does signify certainly China's continuing interest in Africa. I don't think that it impacts particularly upon U.S.-Africa relations. Africa's a huge continent, 54 countries. There's room for everybody. The U.S. shouldn't worry about this.
Well, the last word to you, J. Peter Pham, with respect to the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. How significant is this?
Well, I think Africa shouldn't be reduced to the arena for a zero-sum competition between the United States and China. On the other hand, I think we shouldn't necessarily be Pollyannish about China is going to pursue its advantage. Very interestingly, just last month, China announced the creation for the first time since the People's Republic of China was created of a foreign base for the People's Liberation Army. It's going to be in Djibouti, where coincidentally the United States has a base, Japanese have an air base, and the French have a base. Now the Chinese, their first base anywhere in the world outside China, and it's in Africa. It shows Africa's continuing importance to China, but also the fact that China's terms of relationship with Africa are, as Ambassador Shin noted, they are shifting subtly. It's too soon. You can't draw conclusions from one data point, but certainly it's a very telling and significant data point nonetheless.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador David Shin, former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Gentlemen, as always, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.